Case number 21-5716, United States of America versus Rodney Brown. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Shad for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm here this morning representing Rodney Brown, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Supreme Court in Old Chief decided in 1997 found that in a criminal prosecution where there's an element of the offense that is a status offense, that is the status of the defendant at the time the crime was allegedly committed, that upon a request for a stipulation to that element, the government must accede to that requested stipulation, and the district court must accept that stipulation. In the Old Chief case, it was a 922G, and it was felon in possession, so the status element was whether or not the defendant was a felon that was disqualified from possessing a firearm. In this case, which is really the same exact facts, the status element of the offense was that the defendant was had been convicted of a sex offense or a covered sex offense and was required to register because of that conviction under SORNA. The defense in this case offered to stipulate to that element, which is the first element of the offense. The government refused that stipulation in a pretrial hearing.
And you agreed?
We did not agree, Your Honor.
Well, there's something in the record that shows you.
So there is a point in the process where the defense counsel at the time acceded to not pursuing the argument, but that was only after a couple of different findings by the district court, which made it impractical. So the offer of stipulation was to element one of the offense. The district court said, in order for this to work, and by the way, I'm not required to allow the government to do this, that's what the district court said, but you're going to have to not only accede to element one of the offense, the status offense, but you're going to have to accede to element three as well. So out of the three elements of the offense, the district court said you have to stipulate to one and three in order for this to possibly work. And the court didn't even say that it was going to do it at that time, but said that that was what's going to be required in order to do it. And as a matter of fact, the government made that argument to the court at the time that, Judge, we need the underlying facts of this conviction to prove both one and three. And so, based upon the what I call the counteroffer,
did they need one and three for the conviction?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did they need one and three for the conviction?
Absolutely. They needed all three. They needed elements one, two, and three.
Well, then what was wrong with what they said?
There's nothing wrong with them saying they need to prove elements one, two, and three, but they don't. It would be akin to in the Old Chief case, right? If the issue in Old Chief was, I will stipulate that I'm a felon, and then the government comes back and says, we want you to stipulate that you're a felon, and also we want you to stipulate that you possess the firearm on that date. Because that's what it would be akin to, and the district court saying, yes, you have to accede to both that element and that element, otherwise you don't get an Old Chief stipulation. And that's not what the Supreme Court said.
The Old Chief, we've had opinion after opinion in the circuit court saying it's an exception, period, for the possession as a felon. And we're not going to extend it any further. And what you're doing then is asking us to extend the Old Chief exception. Am I correct?
I'm not asking you to extend it. I'm asking you to follow its requirement. And so the difference here is, so the cases that you're, I think, referring to, Judge Norris, so one of them is the O'Day case. And the O'Day said this was a case about... this is a case about 922G in particular. But if you look at the Old Chief decision, it doesn't limit itself in any way to just 922G cases. That would be akin to saying, Let's say the Johnson case, which was the 2015 case that overturned the ACCA and what constituted a violent felony. You know, that exception clause, saying that because that case involved a burglary as an underlying offense, that Johnson only applies when it's an underlying burglary. And that's clearly not the case. It's read broader than that, even though it was, in fact, an ACCA case that was a 922G in that case. So in Old Chief, they didn't, the distinction they made was, is the element a status element? And when the element is a status element, then there are two ways you can prove it up. One is through proving the prior conviction, and the other is a stipulation to the prior conviction. And the Supreme Court said, in that particular instance, there is no greater weight to one or the other. However, under 403, the prejudice as to the first of those clearly outweighs the relevant value of presenting that to a jury, and that's why we, upon stipulation, we can't allow evidence on that topic. And so that plays out in this case perfectly, because
they had to prove part three.
They do. And part three.
So they could have said, he's stipulated to being a sexual deviant, and we're going to prove part three.
So part three is actually not a status element. Part three is that part two is he crossed state lines. Part three is that while in Tennessee, he didn't register under SORNA. That's what element three is. It has nothing to do with his status as a felon or a covered sex offense. It's what actions or inactions did he do while he was in Tennessee. And that's why you prove that through evidence. But that evidence, the fact of whether or not he performed the registration or didn't perform the registration as required under SORNA has nothing to do with the facts underlying his 1992 criminal conviction. They didn't need any facts with regards to that conviction to prove that third element in the offense. And that's why this counteroffer that they must prove, that they must stipulate to both one and three, is what makes any subsequent alleged withdrawal invalid in this case.
Now, your argument about Old Chief and all that's before us on plain error review, correct?
Well, I would disagree with that. So, I will disagree for two reasons. Number one, the defense actually filed a pretrial motion to stipulate to this offense and stipulate to element one of the offense, and pressed that initially in the pretrial motion. So
the evidentiary issue was not decided at that time, was it?
Yeah, actually, it was decided, the evidentiary issue, on whether or not they were going to allow additional evidence, or that underlying evidence as to the 1992 conviction, was actually decided on the first day of trial. So at the first day of trial, the judge, and this starts on page,
which was later.
Well, it was, but it shows that it wasn't waived, and it can't be plain error, because the judge wouldn't be ruling on it the first day of trial if it had been withdrawn or waived. So on page 675, which is the first day of trial, this is page ID 675, the judge actually makes findings and says, here are the reasons that I'm going to allow the underlying evidence on this 1992 conviction, and, oh, by the way, this 1987 conviction, to come in. And that's when those findings are made. So it can't be under plain error, because not only did the defense press it twice, but the court made findings on it both at the pretrial and at the first day of trial.
Okay. Well, if we disagree with your argument, with your Old Chief argument, where would that leave your appeal? You've got this other issue of whether this Mr. Edge should have been permitted to testify both as an expert and as a fact witness. If you lose on this Old Chief issue, does that, this second issue, become irrelevant, or where would your appeals, what arguments would you have left if you lost on this Old Chief argument you're making?
So if I were to lose on the Old Chief argument, I would still have the Edge argument, because it's separate from it, but I will admit that that is on plain air review. So the second issue that I raise in my brief as to Detective Edge being this hybrid opinion and fact witness is on plain air review, but nonetheless, it's still air because it's in direct...
The opinion you're talking about is when he discusses the law, is that when the witness discusses the law that's applicable? Is that what you call opinion?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah,
Well, he was either correct or incorrect, wasn't he?
That's true, Your Honor.
And if he was correct and he didn't do it, wouldn't the court have to instruct that at some point?
Well, it's up to the again, this is the government's burden of proof, not the defense or the courts.
So the jury would have known about it anyway.
Not necessarily, because the government may not have presented a witness that could testify to those things.
I don't know that they needed a witness to testify as to what the law is.
Well, it's more than just, you know, quote unquote, what the law is, because this witness, Officer Edge, testified as to how SORNA was formed. He testified as to what SORNA did. He testified as to what Michigan law was.
What he did is a fact question, isn't it?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor, because the difference between an opinion witness and a fact witness is a fact witness has firsthand knowledge. So it's what they observed. So the part where he says, I went to this person's house and I saw them walking out of the house, which is one of the things that Edge did, that's certainly fact witness. That is a fact. The in SORNA, these types of cases are considered covered sex offenses. That is clearly opinion witness evidence, and it required two things. Number one, it required the government to let the defense know prior to trial that it was bringing an opinion witness so that that opinion witness could be challenged if proper. And number two, it required a limiting instruction to the jury as to how they were to weigh the different facets of this particular witness's testimony. And this goes back to Lopez Medina, which is a 2006 case. I see my time is up. I hope that I've answered your question, Judge Sir Heinrich.
Well, you didn't answer unless you've already done so.
Well, I would just say that this issue comes up very frequently, and I raise it very frequently because even though this occurred, Lopez Medina occurred in 2006, the government continues to do this in case after case.
Thank you very much. You'll have your rebuttal.
May it please the court. Good morning. Naya Bedine for the United States. This court should affirm Mr. Brown's conviction. Mr. Brown first challenges the court's refusal to force the government into a stipulation. This argument fails for three independent reasons. First, Mr. Brown has waived the issue. It is true that Mr. Brown raised the issue in a motion and also at the pretrial hearing. However, at the pretrial hearing, Mr. Brown conferred with his attorney, and after a brief discussion, his attorney said, we'll just waive stipulation. Having talked to Mr. Brown, I think we don't need to stipulate. Your Honor, this was a plain, explicit concession on the record.
Which of the issues are you referring to right now?
I'm referring to the nature of the prior conviction, Your Honor. Starting with Mr. Right. Brown's challenge to the admission of his prior conviction. And as to that conviction, Mr. Brown specifically said, we'll just waive stipulation. Having talked to Mr. Brown, I think we don't need to stipulate. The court had not made a ruling at that point. Right before the stipulation, the court was discussing with the parties the prejudice and the probative value of the evidence. And the court said, I think you all should consider whether there's a way to get there. This shows that the court was still encouraging the parties to agree to a stipulation. After Mr. Brown said, we will waive stipulation, the court said, very good, and immediately moved on to a different subject. The next day, which was the first day of the trial, the court again explained its decision, and Mr. Brown did not raise any other issues particular as relating to that stipulation, which shows that even at that time, the waiver was still effective. And as I said, the court moved on to other issues. To the extent that the defendant argued that the court had already announced its decision, I want to point the court to a case where we cite in our brief that a defendant can waive a known claim even by agreeing in open court with the judge's proposed course of conduct. The explicit waiver by Mr. Brown in this case foreclosed the issue before the district court, and it should foreclose the issue before this court. But even if the court thinks that the waiver is not effective in this case, the court did not abuse its discretion in refusing the government to stipulate. The nature of Mr. Brown's prior conviction in this case had multiple utility. It was probative not only as to the first element, which was whether Mr. Brown was required to register, but it was also probative as to the third element, whether he knew he had to register in Tennessee. This, Your Honor, is a case about knowledge. As we argued at the pretrial hearing and at trial, we argued because of this prior conviction, Mr. Brown knew he had a lifetime duty to register. And this particular conviction and the nature of the conviction is relevant to knowledge for two different reasons. The first reason is, given the nature, the serious nature of the conviction, Mr. Brown had to know that he had to register for life, no matter which state he lived. For instance, Your Honor, if Mr. Brown had been had a prior conviction for a misdemeanor, he might know that a misdemeanor conviction only requires him to register for a couple of years. But the nature of this felony conviction and the amount of time he served on that conviction was so significant that he should have known a lifetime duty to register followed him in Tennessee. And the second point I want to emphasize, Your Honor, that's even more directly related to knowledge, is that in 2005, Mr. Brown signed an explanation of duties to register form. This was Exhibit 3 that we introduced at trial, and it's in the appendix at page 10. And in that form, Mr. Brown stated that he understood he had to register for life for a criminal sexual conduct in the second degree involving a person under 13. It was that particular sub-statute of the second degree statute that he had to register for. So not everything, not every second degree sexual conduct offense, but one that involves someone under the age of 13. He signed that he understood he had to register for that offense, and we had to present it to the jury that he did have that offense, and then he signed that he knew he had to register for that offense. My last point as to knowledge, Your Honor, is that the government is entitled to present a comprehensive and coherent story that proves that Mr. Brown had to register in Tennessee. And in this case, the government showed at trial that Mr. Brown had a prior conviction, 1987 conviction. He did have some obligation to register as to that conviction. And then in 1992, he had an even more serious conviction. Given the serious nature, he should have known he had to register for a longer time. And then in 2005, when Mr. Brown was released, having served the sentence for the 1992 conviction, he in fact registered for a long time, from 2005 until 2015. So the government attempted to show through this proof that Mr. Brown had a familiarity with registration rules, and he had in fact complied. And I submit, Your Honor, those are both relevant to whether he knew he had to register. I also want to point out that in pages 23 and 24 of our brief, we cited some cases. There's not a lot of SORNA cases, but we did find some cases where this court and other courts have allowed proof of a prior conviction. Specifically in Harper, the prior conviction was one that involved a minor, and courts have allowed proof and have stated that proof of the nature is relevant to the SORNA offenses. And third, as to this first argument, we would argue that any error was harmless. And that's because there was sufficient other evidence in the record to show that Mr. Brown knew, should have known he had to register in Tennessee. In particular, I want to point out, this was Exhibit 3, which was the Michigan registry documents. Mr. Brown signed an explanation of duties form. In particular, in that form, it was from 2005, but he stated that he understood he had to register if he moved to a different state, and then periodically he registered in Michigan until 2015. If the court has no other questions as to this issue, I'd like to move to the second issue in this case. Mr. Brown argues that the court erred in allowing the use of a hybrid and fact witness, and defense counsel pointed out, this is plain error review because he did not object to the use of this witness. I submit, Your Honor, that there was no error in the testimony. The agent testified regarding his direct knowledge of the investigation. The agent had to find out what Mr. Brown's prior convictions were and whether Mr. Brown had a lifetime duty to register, and he testified as to both of those facts. Those are facts that he had to determine in order to find out if Mr. Brown had broken the law.
As to the opinion testimony offered by the witness, what information is there to indicate that the witness was qualified to offer those opinions?
We submit, Your Honor, he did not offer any expert opinions. Nothing he said required any specialized knowledge. He testified that Mr. Brown had a lifetime duty to register, but I want to point out that that was all in Exhibit 3.
Well, there was some specialized knowledge. He was talking about the National Sex Offender Registry and what people are required to do under SORNA, and not everybody would be familiar with those procedures.
That's true, Your Honor, and we submit that that's background information, and we relied on the Kilpatrick case. The agent was asked, you know, about his duties in his position, and he said that he prosecutes SORNA cases, and then in order for his testimony to be helpful to the jury, he was asked what SORNA was, and I submit his limited discussion of SORNA and the fact that Michigan had a registry and Tennessee had a registry and that there was a database is just background information. It doesn't go to any of the elements of the offense. It set the stage for Exhibit 3 to come in, which was the Michigan registry documents, and it was not used by the government for the truth, but merely as a background to explain how the agent, what the agent was investigating and how the agent arrived at his conclusions. And I also want to point out, Your Honor, that that's easily verifiable information. It was not wrong. It was not speculative. Under Rule 702, expert opinions are based on data, and this was not extrapolating for any set of data, and it was reliable information. As to the other statements by the agent regarding the fact that Mr. Brown was a Tier 3 offender, as I pointed out, all that information was in front of the jury. The jury had all that information. As a layperson, any juror could have arrived at the same information themselves. Also, that information was not speculative. I want to point out that the judge had already determined legally that Mr. Brown was a Tier 3 offender. So the agent was not offering any speculation or opinions as to the matter. And lastly, Your Honor, I want to point out that this agent testified that he had been a U.S. Marshal since 2011, and he had worked in SORNA cases for most of that time. So to the extent the court thinks that any of the statements he gave was perhaps an expert opinion, the government's failure to officially designate him as an expert would have been harmless in light of the fact that he was obviously qualified and also in light of the fact of everything else that I've stated here. If the court has no other questions, I ask that this court affirm the district court's judgment. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any rebuttal?
Perhaps the biggest problem with not allowing this stipulation is the fact that at the end of trial, the government instructs the jury as a matter of law that the 1992 offense...
That's pretty clear that he waived that problem.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. So again, if you start on page 1019 of the transcript, of the pretrial transcript, both the government argued and the court said that in order for this to work, you're going to have to stipulate not just to element one, but element three. And so it's a counteroffer. So to say that that the defense wouldn't agree to stipulate to counts one and three, and therefore that constitutes a waiver of this issue, I don't think is a fair reading of the record at all. And while, if it was waived in the pretrial, why would the court make findings of fact at the beginning of trial on this very topic? Because if it was waived, there'd be no reason for the court to say anything.
Counsel, but to ask me to understand what goes on in the mind of a district judge is beyond my pay grade.
Thank you, Your Honor. But here's the other problem, though. So at the end of the trial, the jury is instructed as a matter of law by this district judge that this offense is a sex offense that's covered and that he had a duty to register under SORNA as a matter of law. So not only was it taken out of the jury's hands at the end of trial, element one, but he was denied the right to stipulate it and blunt the effects of the evidence. And keep in mind, the effects of the evidence are that he had a sex offense with somebody under 13, that he got sentenced to up to 15 years in jail, and that he actually served 13 years in jail for all of that. Why would any of that be relevant to showing that he was guilty of a sex offense which was covered under SORNA when he offered to stipulate to it and the jury was instructed as a matter of law that he was? It was completely irrelevant and it was highly inflammatory to the rest of the trial.
I don't understand the argument from the standpoint that your client spends years registering as a sex offender in Michigan, and then he's now claiming that he was prejudiced in Tennessee, I guess that's the state we're in now, when he moved to Tennessee, that he had to prove that he was that the government had to prove that he was a sex offender when he had admitted it in a sense, or at least maybe he didn't voluntarily register, but he had spent years registering as a sex offender. Why would that even be an issue?
Absolutely, Your Honor. If I can complete my responses, you're exactly right. There is no issue here. He was willing to stipulate to that. He just didn't want the facts to come out.
Guilt, then?
Pardon me?
I'm a little confused. If you're stipulating to something they need not prove, then were you not stipulating to guilt?
No, Your Honor.
Enter a guilty plea.
No, Your Honor, because there's three elements that the government has to prove. Just because he's merely willing to stipulate to one doesn't mean that they can prove the other two.
But the court held, and at least the prosecutor advocated, that they needed to talk about the underlying facts of the convictions to prove those other things.
And I would submit that not only is that not true under the law, but that the instruction that they should find it as a matter of law at the end of the instructions makes it wholly irrelevant. So how can the jury be required to delve into whether or not this was a qualifying offense, and then they get to the end of the case and the judge instructs them as a matter of law it is a qualifying offense? There was no basis for that evidence, and it was highly inflammatory. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Case is submitted.